the way home. I slid the Pino's pizza box onto my kitchen counter, kicked my shoes off, and got a beer out of the fridge. I punched the message button on my machine and listened to my messages while I ate.
Stephanie, it's your mother. Hello? Are you there?
Disconnect. Second message.
Bad news. I'm gonna punk out on lunch tomorrow. The kids are sick.
It was my best friend, Mary Lou. Mary Lou and I grew up together. We went to school together, and we were married within months of each other. Mary Lou's marriage stuck, and she had a pack of kids. My marriage lasted about 20 minutes and ended in a screaming divorce. The third message was from Vinny.
What are you doing at home listening to this dumb machine? Why aren't you out looking for Sing? I'm dying here, for Christ's sake. Do something.
And my mother again.
I didn't want anything the first time. You don't have to call me back.
I erased the messages and dropped a tiny piece of pizza into Rex's cage. Rex is my hamster roommate. He lives in a glass aquarium in my kitchen and sleeps in a Campbell's tomato soup can. Rex rushed out of his soup can, shoved the pizza into his cheek pouch, and scurried back to the can. Quality pet time. I carted the pizza box, the beer, and my purse into the living room, flopped onto the couch, powered up the television, and found a Seinfeld rerun. A couple months ago, I entered the computer age and bought myself an Apple iBook. I keep the iBook on my coffee table so I can check my mail and watch television at the same time. Am I a multitasker or what? I opened the iBook and signed on. I deleted the junk mail advertising Viagra, mortgage rates, and porn sites. A single message was left. It was from Andrew Cohn. If I can be of any further help, don't hesitate to call. The phone jarred me awake at 7 a.m.
Something just came across my desk and I thought you might want to see, Morelli said. I'm at the station and I have a few things to do, and then I'll come over.
I dragged myself out of the bed and into the bathroom. I did the shower thing and the hair thing and a half-assed job at the makeup thing. I got dressed in my usual uniform of t-shirt and jeans and felt ready to face the day. I made coffee and treated myself to a strawberry Pop-Tart, feeling righteous because I'd resisted the s'mores Pop-Tart. Best to have fruit for breakfast, right? I gave a corner of the Pop-Tart to Rex and sipped my coffee. I was pouring myself a second cup of coffee when Morelli arrived. He backed me against a wall, made certain there were no spaces between us, and he kissed me. His pager buzzed, and he did some inventive cussing. Trouble? I asked. He looked at the display.
The usual crap.
He stepped back and pulled a folded piece of paper out of his jacket pocket.
I knew there was some sort of mess associated with Tribro, so I ran a search for you. It turned up this newspaper article from 2 years ago.
I took the paper from Morelli and read the headline, Bart Cohn Charged in Parisi Slaying. The article went on to say that hikers had stumbled over the body of Lillian Parisi just hours after Parisi had been killed with a single shot to the head at close range. The murder had occurred in a wooded area just north of Washington's Crossing State Park. Cohn had been spotted leaving the scene, and police claimed to have physical evidence linking Cohn to the murder. What happened? I asked Morelli.
He was released. The witness who reported Cohn fleeing from the scene recanted part of his story, and the physical evidence tested out negative. Cohn had been carrying a .22 when the police picked him up for questioning. Parisi had been shot with a .22, but ballistics ruled out Cohn's gun as the murder weapon. And there wasn't a DNA matchup. Parisi had been sexually assaulted after her death, and the DNA didn't match to Cohn. As I remember, the guys assigned to the case still thought Cohn killed Parisi. They just couldn't get anything to stick on him, and the case has never been solved.
Was there a motive?
No motive. They were never able to develop a connection between Parisi and Cohn.
Bart Cohn isn't exactly Mr. Nice Guy, but it's hard to see him as a killer.
Killers come in all sizes, Morelli said.
Chapter 3. Morelli walked me to my car, gave me a dismissive kiss on the forehead, and told me to be careful. He was driving a piece-of-shit cop car that was parked next to my Ford. It was a Crown Vic that probably had originally been dark blue, but had now faded to a color that defied description. Paint was scraped off the right rear, and part of the back bumper was ripped away. A Kojak light was rolling around on the floor in the back. "Nice car," I said to Morelli.
"Yeah, I had a hard choice to make between this and the Ferrari."
He angled into the Vic, cranked it over, and rolled out of the lot. It was early morning, but already the day was heating up. I could hear the drone of traffic not far off on Hamilton. The sky was murky above me, and I felt the rasp of ozone in the back of my throat. As the day wore on, cars, chemical plants, and backyard barbecues would make their contribution to the stew that cooked over Jersey. Fancy Pants wimps in L.A. rated their pollution and curtailed activity. In Jersey, we just call it air and get on with life. If you're born in Jersey, you know how to rise to a challenge. Bring on the mob. Bring on bad air. Bring on taxes and obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and macaroni at every meal. Nothing defeats us in Jersey. First thing on my activities list was a drive around the Apusenja neighborhood, keeping my eyes peeled for Boo and Sing. Sometimes missing persons turned up surprisingly close to home. They moved in with neighbors, hid out in garages, and sometimes turned up dead in a dumpster. Neither Boo nor Sing showed up after 15 minutes of searching, so I headed across town to Route 1 and Tribro. I still didn't have a clear idea of Tribro's product. Parts for slot machines. What did that mean? Gears? Handles? Bells and whistles? Not that it mattered. What mattered was squeezing a lead out of someone. Black Bart hadn't been impressed with my charm or cleavage. I didn't think I'd get a lot of help from him. Clyde was eager, but not real bright. Andrew seemed like my best shot. I took the turnoff to Tribro and called Andrew on my cell phone. "Guess what?" I said. "I'm in the neighborhood. Can I take a couple more minutes of your time?"
"Absolutely."
"Absolutely" was a good answer. Very positive. No sign of annoyance. No lecherous side remark. Professional. Andrew was definitely the brother of choice. I parked in the lot, entered the lobby, and was immediately directed to Andrew's office. More good luck. No Bart or Clyde to slow me down. I took a chair across from Andrew and thanked him for seeing me.
"Tribro has an interest in finding Sing," he said. "We sign for the visa bond. If Sing skips, Tribro pays the bill."
"Do you have other employees on work visas?"
"Not now, but we have in the past. And I have to tell you, Sing isn't the first to disappear."
I felt my eyebrows raise.
"It's nothing suspicious," Andrew said. "In fact, I find it understandable. If I was in a similar position, I might disappear too. These men come to work for 3 months and are seduced by the potential for success. Everything is within their reach. Rental movies, burgers, designer jeans, a new car, microwave popcorn, and frozen waffles. I have some sympathy for their plight, but at the same time, Tribro can't keep absorbing bond losses. If this sort of thing continues, we'll have to stop using visa workers. And that would be a shame, because they make very good temporary employees."
"Sing must have had some friends on the job. I'd like to talk to them." Andrew Cohn sat through a couple beats of silence, his eyes holding mine, his thoughts private, his expression guarded.
"Why don't we put you undercover?" he finally said. "I can give you Sing's job for a day. We haven't filled it yet."
"I'm not even sure what you make here."
"We make little things, machine-tooled gears and locks. Sing's job primarily consisted of measuring minutiae. Each part we supply must be perfect. The first day on board, you wouldn't be expected to know much."
He reached for his phone, and his mouth tipped into a small smile.
"Let's see how good you are at bluffing."
10 minutes later, I was a genuine, bogus Tribro employee, following after Andrew, learning about Tribro Tech. The gears and locks that composed the bulk of Tribro's product were made at workstations housed in a large warehouse-type facility adjoining the reception area and offices. The far end of the warehouse was divided off into a long room where the quality control work was done. Windows looked into the interior. In the entire facility, there were no windows looking out. The quality control area consisted of a series of cubbies with built-in tables, shelves, and cabinets. The tables held an odd assortment of weights, measures, machine torture devices, and chemicals. A single worker occupied each of the tables. There were 7 people in the quality control area, and there was 1 unoccupied table, Singh's table. Andrew introduced me to the area supervisor, Ann Klimmer, and returned to his office. Ann took me table by table and introduced me to the rest of the team. The women were in their 30s and 40s. There were 2 men. One of the men was Asian. Singh would have gravitated to the Asian, I thought, but the women would warm to me faster. After the introductions and an overview lecture on the operation, I was partnered with Jane Locarelli. Jane looked like she'd just rolled off an embalming table. She was late 40s, rail thin, and drained of color. Even her hair was faded. She spoke in a monotone, never making eye contact, her words slightly slurred, as if the effort of speech was too much to manage.
"I've worked here for 31 years," she said. "I started working for the senior cones right out of high school."
No wonder she looked like a walking cadaver. 31 years under fluorescent lights, measuring and torturing little metal doohickeys. Jeez. Jane hitched herself up onto a stool and selected a small gear from a huge barrel of small gears.
"We do 2 kinds of testing here. We do random testing of new product."
She sent me an apologetic grimace.
"I'm afraid that's a little tedious."
She displayed the gear she held in her hand.
"And we test parts which have failed and been returned. That sort of testing is much more interesting. Unfortunately, today we're testing new product."
Jane carefully measured each part of the gear and examined it under a microscope for flaws. When she was done, she reached into the barrel and selected another gear. I had to bite back a groan. 2 gears down, 3,000 gears to go.
"I heard Singh didn't show up for work one day," I said, going for casual curious. "Was he unhappy with the job?"
"Not sure," Jane said, concentrating on the new gear. "He wasn't very talkative."
After extensive measuring, she decided the gear was okay and went on to a third.
"Would you like to try one?" she asked.
"Sure."
She handed the gear over and showed me how to measure.
"Looks good to me," I said after doing the measuring thing.
"No," she said. "It's off on one side. See the little burr on the edge of the one cog?"
Jane took the gear from me, filed the side, and measured again.
"Maybe you should just watch a while longer," she said.
I watched Jane do 4 more gears, and my eyes glazed over and some drool oozed from between my lips. I quietly slid from my stool and moved to the next cubicle. Dolly Friedman was also testing new gears. Dolly would drink some coffee and measure. Then she'd drink more coffee and perform another test. She was as thin and pale as Jane, but not as lifeless. She was cranked on coffee.
"This is such a bullshit job," Dolly said to me.
She looked around.
"Anyone watching?" she asked.
Then she took a handful of gears and dumped them into the perfect gear bucket.
"They look good to me," she said.
Then she drank more coffee.
"I'm going to be doing Samuel Singh's job," I told her. "Do you know what happened to him?
I heard he just didn't show up for work one day."
"Yeah, that's what I heard, too. No one said much about him. He was real quiet. Carried his computer around and spent all his breaks on the computer."
"Playing computer games?"
"No. He was always plugged into a phone line. Surfing, doing email. Real secretive about it, too. If someone came over to him, he'd close up the computer. Probably was on some porno site. He looked like the type."
"Slimy?"
"Male. I keep protection in my desk for those types."
She opened her top desk drawer to show me her canister of pepper spray. To move around the room, saving Edgar, the Asian guy, for last. Several of the women thought Singh looked unhappy. Alice Louise thought he might be secretly gay. No one could fault his work habits. He arrived on time, and he did his barrel. No one knew he was engaged. No one had any idea where he lived or what he did in his spare time, other than surf the net. Everyone had seen the newspaper article and thought Vinny looked like a weasel. I called Ranger at noon.
Joe,
Ranger said. Just checking in.
How are the folks at Tribro?
Not giving me a lot, but it's still early.
Go get him, babe.
And he disconnected. I drifted over to Edgar's table mid-afternoon. Edgar was dropping acid on a small metal bar with threads at either end. One drop at a time. Drip, wait, and measure. Drip, wait, and measure. Drip, wait, and measure. There had to be 1,000 bars waiting to be tortured. Nothing was happening. This job made watching grass grow look exciting.
We're testing a new alloy, Edgar said.
This seems more interesting than the gear measuring.
Only for the first 2 million bars. After that, it's pretty routine.
Why do you keep this job?
Benefits.
Health insurance?
Gambling. If the product fails, one of us goes to Vegas as a tech rep, and the products fail all the time.
What's a tech rep?
A technical representative. You know, a repairman.
Did Singh ever go to Vegas?
Once.
And you?
On an average, once a month. Failure is usually stress-related, and that's my area of expertise.
Did Singh like Vegas?
Why are you so interested in Singh? Edgar asked.
I'm taking over his job.
If you were taking over his job, you'd be sitting at his desk doing measurements. Instead, you're floating around talking to everyone. I think you're looking for Singh.
A point for Edgar. Okay, suppose I am looking for Singh. Would you know where to find him?
No, but I know where to start looking. The day before he disappeared, he was in the lunchroom calling all the McDonald's places, asking if a guy named Howie worked there. It was pretty strange. He was all excited, and it was the first time I'd ever seen him make a call.
I looked through the window into the manufacturing area, and I caught Bart Cohn's eye. He was examining a machine, standing with three other men. He glanced up and saw me talking to Edgar.
That's not a happy face, Edgar said, his attention shifting to Bart.
Does he ever have a happy face?
Yeah, I saw him smile once when he ran over a toad in the parking lot.
Bart made a wait here gesture to the men at the machine and marched across the work floor to the test area. He wrenched the door open and asked me to follow him out to the offices. I took my purse, since it was the end of the day and there wasn't much chance I'd be returning. Bart was once again dressed in black. His expression was menacing. I followed him into an office that smelled like metal shavings and was a cluttered mess of stacked catalogs and spare parts collected in tattered cardboard boxes. His desk was large, the top heaped with loose papers, disposable coffee cups, more spare parts, a multi-line phone, and a workstation computer.
"What the hell were you doing in there?" Bart asked, looking like a guy who might have murdered Lillian Parisi. I thought I made it clear that we had nothing to tell you about Singh.
Your brother feels otherwise. He suggested I work undercover for a day. Bart snatched at his phone and punched a key on speed dial.
What's the deal with Ms. Plum? He asked. I found her in the test area.
His expression darkened at Andrew's answer. He gave a terse reply, returned the handset to the cradle, and glared at me.
I don't care what my brother told you. I'm going to give you good advice and God help you if you don't follow it. Stay out of my factory.
Sure, I said. Okie dokie. And I left. I might be a little slow sometimes, but I'm not totally stupid. I know a genuinely scary dude when I see one, and Bart was a genuinely scary dude. My cell phone rang as I was pulling out of the lot. Stephanie, it's your mother. As if I wouldn't recognize her voice. We're having a nice chicken for dinner tonight. My unmarried sister was 9 months pregnant, living with my parents, and had turned into the hormone queen. I'd have to endure Valerie's mood swings to get to the chicken dinner. Valerie's boyfriend, Albert Clown, would most likely be there too. Clown was also Valerie's boss and the father of her unborn baby. Clown was a struggling lawyer, and he was practically living at the house, trying to get Valerie to marry him, not to mention Valerie's two little girls by a previous marriage, who were nice kids but added to the bedlam potential. "Mashed potatoes with gravy," my mother said, sensing my hesitation, sweetening the offer. "Gee, I sort of have things to do," I said. "Pineapple upside-down cake for dessert," my mother said, pulling out the big gun. "Extra whipped cream." And she knew she had me. I'd never in my life turned down pineapple upside-down cake. I looked at my watch. "I'm about 20 minutes away. I'll be a couple minutes late. Start without me." Everyone was at the table when I arrived. My sister Valerie was pushed back about a foot and a half to accommodate her beach ball belly. A couple weeks ago, she'd started using the belly like a shelf, balancing her plate on it, tucking her napkin into the neck of her shirt, catching spilled food on her huge, swollen breasts. She'd gained 70 pounds with the baby, and she was all big boobs and double chins and ham hock arms. Unheard of for Valerie, who previous to her divorce had been the perfect daughter, resembling the serene and slim Virgin Mary in every way, with the possible exception of virginity and hairstyle. The hair was Meg Ryan. Albert Clown was at her side, his face round and pink, his scalp gleaming under his thinning sandy hair. He was watching Valerie with unabashed awe and affection. Clown wasn't a subtle guy. He hadn't any idea how to hide an emotion. Probably he wasn't great in a courtroom, but he was always fun at the dinner table, and he was surprisingly endearing in an oddball way. Valerie's two girls from her first and only marriage, Angie and Mary Alice, were on the edges of their seats, hoping for a fun disaster, like Grandma Mazur setting the tablecloth on fire, or Albert Clown spilling hot coffee into his lap. Grandma Mazur was happily sipping her second glass of wine. My mom was at the head of the table, all business, daring anyone to find fault with the chicken. And my dad shoveled food into his mouth and acknowledged me with a grunt.
"I read in the paper where aliens from a different galaxy are buying up all the good real estate in Albany," Grandma said.
"They'll get hit hard with taxes," Clown told her. "They'd be better to buy real estate in Florida or Texas."
My father never raised his head, but his eyes slid first to Clown and then to my grandmother. He muttered something that was too low to carry. I suspected it was in the area of good grief. My father is retired from the post office, and now he drives a cab part-time. When my grandmother came to live with my parents, my mother stopped storing the rat poison in the garage. Not that my father would actually take to poisoning my grandmother, but why tempt fate? Better to store the rat poison at Cousin Betty's house.
"If I was an alien, I'd rather live in Florida anyway," Grandma said. "Florida has Disney World. What's Albany got?"
Valerie looked like she was ready to drop the baby on the dining room floor.
"Get me a gun," Valerie said. "If I don't go into labor soon, I'm going to shoot myself. And pass the gravy. Pass it now."
My mother jumped to her feet and handed the gravy boat to Valerie.
"Sometimes the contractions are hardly noticeable in the beginning," my mother said. "Do you think you could be having hardly noticeable contractions?"
Valerie's attention was fully focused on the gravy. She poured gravy on everything: vegetables, applesauce, chicken, dressing, and a heap of rolls.
"I love gravy,"
she said, spooning the overflow into her mouth, eating the gravy like soup.
"I dream about gravy."
"It's a little high in saturated fats," Clown said.
Valerie glanced sideways at Clown.
"You're not going to lecture me on my diet, are you?"
Clown sat up straight in his seat, his eyes wide and bird-like.
"Me? No, honest, I wouldn't do anything like that. I like fat women. Just the other day, I was thinking how fat women were soft. Nothing I like better than big, soft, squishy pillows of fat."
He was nodding his balding head, trying hard, running down dark roads of panic.
"Look at me. I'm nice and fat, too. I'm like the doughboy. Go ahead, poke my stomach. I'm just like the doughboy," Clown said.
"Oh, my God," my sister wailed. "You think I'm fat?"
She went into open-mouthed sobbing, and the plate slid from her stomach and crashed onto the floor.
Clown bent to retrieve the plate and farted.
"That wasn't me," he said.
"Maybe it was me," Grandma said. "Sometimes they sneak out. Did I fart?"
she asked everyone.
My eyes inadvertently went to the kitchen door.
"Don't even think about it," my mother said. "We're all in this together. Anyone sneaks out the back way, they answer to me."
When the table was cleared and the dishes were done, I made my move to leave.
"I need to talk to you," my mother said, following me out of the house to stand curbside where we had privacy.
The bottom of the sun had sunk into the Kriensky's asbestos shingle roof, a sure sign that the day was ending. Kids ran in packs, burning off the last of their energy. Parents and grandparents sat on small front porches. The air was dead still, heavy with the promise of a hot tomorrow. Inside my parents' house, my father and grandmother sat glued to the television. The muffled rise and fall of a sitcom laugh track escaped the house and joined the mix of street noise.
"I'm worried about your sister," my mother said. "What's to become of her? A baby due in 2 weeks and no husband. She should marry Albert. You have to talk to her."
"No way. One minute she's all smiley face and crying because she loves me so much, and the next thing I know she's grumpy. I want the old Valerie back, the one with no personality. And besides, I'm not exactly an expert at marriage. Look at me. I can't even figure out my own life."
"I'm not asking a lot. I just want you to talk to her. Get her to understand that she's having a baby."
"Mom, she knows she's having a baby. She's as big as a Volkswagen. She's already done it twice before."
"Yes, but both times she did it in California. It's not the same. And she had a husband then, and a house."
"Okay, now we're getting somewhere. This is about the house, right?"
"I feel like the old lady who lived in a shoe. Remember the rhyme? She had so many children she didn't know what to do? One more person in this house and we're going to have to sleep in shifts. Your father's talking about renting a porta potty for the backyard. And it's not just the house. This is the Berg. Women don't go off and have babies without husbands here. Every time I go to the grocery, I meet someone who wants to know when Valerie is getting married."
I thought this was a good deal. It used to be that people wanted to know when I was getting married.
"She's in the kitchen eating the rest of the cake," my mother said. "She's probably got it topped with gravy. You could go in and talk to her. Tell her Albert Clown is a good man."
"Valerie doesn't want to hear this from me."
"What's it going to take?" my mother wanted to know.
"German chocolate torte?"
The German chocolate torte took hours to make. My mother hated to make the German chocolate torte.
"German chocolate torte and a leg of lamb. That's my best offer," she said.
"Boy, you're really serious."
My mother grabbed me by the front of my shirt.
"I'm desperate. I'm on the window ledge on the 40th floor, and I'm looking down."
I did an eye roll and a sigh, and I trudged back into the house, into the kitchen. Sure enough, Valerie was at the small kitchen table, snarfing down cake.
"Mom wants me to talk to you," I said.
"Not now. I'm busy. I'm eating for two, you know."
"Two elephants."
"Mom thinks you should marry Clown." Valerie forked off a huge piece and shoved it into her mouth.
"Clown's boring. Would you marry Clown?"
"No, but then I won't even marry Morelli."
"I want to marry Ranger. Ranger is hot."
I couldn't deny it. Ranger was hot.
"I don't think Ranger's the marrying type," I said. "And there would be a lot of things to consider. For instance, I think once in a while he might kill people."
"Yeah, but not random, right?"
"Probably not random."
Valerie was scraping at the leftover smudges of whipped cream.
"So that would be okay. Nobody's perfect."
"Okay, then," I said. "Good talk. I'll pass this on to Mom."
"It isn't as if I'm anti-marriage," Valerie said,
eyeing the grease and drippings left in the roasting pan. I backed out of the kitchen and ran into my mom.
"Well?" she asked.
"Valerie's thinking about it. And the good news is, she's not anti-marriage."
Streetlights were on when I cruised into my parking lot. A dog barked in a nearby neighborhood of single-family homes, and I thought of Boo. Mrs. Apicenja told Ranger and me that she tacked lost dog signs up at local businesses and at street corners. The signs had a photo of the dog and offered a small reward, but there'd been no takers. Tomorrow I'd track down Howie. It was my spidey sense again. I had a feeling Howie was important. Singh had been trying to call him. It had to mean something, right? I let myself into my apartment and said howdy to Rex. I checked my phone messages, 3 in all. The first was from Joe.
Hey, Cupcake.
That was it. That was the whole message. The second was from Ranger.
Joe.
Ranger made Joe look like a chatterbox. The third was a hang-up. I ambled into the living room, slouched onto the couch, and grabbed for the remote. A splash of color caught my eye from across the room. The color was coming from a vase of red roses and white carnations sitting on an end table. The flowers hadn't been there this morning. A white envelope was propped against the vase. My first thought was that someone had broken into my apartment. Ranger and Morelli did this on a regular basis, but they'd never left me flowers, and I was pretty certain they hadn't left them this time either. I did a quick backtrack to the kitchen with my heart beating way too hard and too fast in my chest. I took my gun out of the brown bear cookie jar and started creeping through my apartment. There were only 2 rooms left unseen, bedroom and bath. I looked into the bathroom. No creepy deranged killers lurking behind the shower curtain. None on the toilet. The bedroom was also monster-free. I shoved the gun under the waistband of my jeans and returned to the flowers. There was a message printed on the outside of the white envelope. Tag, you're it. I had no idea what this meant. I opened the envelope and removed 3 photos. It took a moment for the images to register. I clapped a hand to my mouth when I figured it out. They were pictures of a gunshot victim, a woman, shot between the eyes. The photos were close-ups that were too tied in to reveal the woman's identity. One photo showed part of an eyebrow and an open, sightless eye. The other 2 recorded the destruction to the back of her head, the exit point. I dropped the photos, ran to the phone, and dialed Joe.
"Someone broke into my apartment," I said, "and they left me flowers and some photos. Should I call the police?"
"Honey, I am the police."
"So I'm covered. Okay, just checking."
"Do you want me to come over?"
"Yes. Drive fast."
Chapter 4. Morelli stood hands on hips, staring at the flowers on the table and the photos still spread out on the floor.
"It's like you have a sign on your door welcoming nuts and stalkers to walk in. Everyone breaks into your apartment. I've never seen anything like it. You have 3 top-of-the-line locks on your door, and it doesn't deter anyone."
He glanced over at me.
"Your door was locked, right?"
"Yes, it was locked."
"Yeesh.
Do you think this is serious?" Morelli looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language.
"Someone broke into your apartment and left you gunshot pictures. Don't you think it's serious?"
"I'm completely freaked out, but I was really hoping you'd tell me I was overreacting. I was going for the outside chance that you'd think this was someone's idea of a joke."
"I hate this," Morelli said. "Why can't I have a girlfriend who has normal problems, like breaking a fingernail or missing a period or falling in love with a lesbian?"
"Now what?" I asked.
"Now I call this in and get a couple guys out here to collect evidence and maybe look for prints. Do you have any idea what this is about?"
"No idea at all. Not a clue. Nothing." The phone rang and I went to the kitchen to answer it.
"I definitely think it might work between Ranger and me," Valerie said. "You're pals with him. You could fix me up."
"Valerie, you're 9 months pregnant. This isn't a good time for a fix-up."
"You think I should wait until after I deliver?"
"I think you should wait until never." Valerie did a big sigh and disconnected. Ranger on a fix-up date. Can you see this?
"You're smiling," Morelli said.
"Valerie wants to get fixed up with Ranger." Now Morelli was smiling.
"I like it. Wear body armor when you tell Ranger."
Morelli opened the refrigerator, took out a piece of leftover pizza, and ate it cold.
I think it would be smart to get you out of this apartment. I don't know what this is about, but I'm not comfortable ignoring it.
And I would go where?
You'd go home with me, Cupcake. And there'd be benefits.
Such as?
I'd warm up your pizza.
Morelli lived in a two-story row house he inherited from his Aunt Rose. It was about a half mile from my parents' house, with an almost identical floor plan. Rooms were stacked one behind the other. Living room, dining room, kitchen. There were three bedrooms and a bath upstairs. Morelli had added a half bath downstairs. He was slowly claiming the house as his own. The wood floors were all newly sanded and varnished, but Aunt Rose's filmy old-fashioned curtains remained. I liked the mix, and in an odd way would be sorry to see the house turn over entirely to Joe. There was something comforting about the curtains enduring beyond Aunt Rose. A tombstone is okay, but curtains are so much more personal. We stood on the small front porch, and Morelli cautioned me as he unlocked his door.
"Brace yourself," he said. "Bob hasn't seen you in a couple days. I don't want you knocked on your ass in front of the neighbors."
Bob was a big, scruffy, red-haired dog that Morelli and I shared. Technically, I suppose it was Morelli's dog. Bob had originally come to live with me, but in the end had chosen Morelli. One of those guy things, I guess. Morelli opened the door, and Bob bounded out, catching me at chest level. What Bob lacked in manners, he made up for in enthusiasm. I hugged him to me and gave him some big, loud kisses. Bob endured this for a beat and then turned tail and hurled himself back inside, galloping from one end of the house to the other, with ears flapping and tongue flopping. A half hour later, I was all settled in, with my car parked at the curb behind Morelli's truck, my clothes in the guest room closet, and Rex's hamster cage sitting on Morelli's kitchen counter.
"I bet you're tired," Morelli said, flipping the lights off in the kitchen. "I bet you can't wait to get into bed."
I gave him a sideways look. He slung an arm around my shoulders and steered me in the direction of the stairs.
"I bet you're so tired you don't even want to bother getting into pajamas. In fact, you might need some help getting out of all these clothes."
"And you're volunteering for the job?" He kissed me at the nape of my neck.
"Am I a good guy or what?"
I woke up in a tangle of sheets and nothing else. Sunlight was streaming through Morelli's bedroom window, and I could hear the shower running in the bathroom. Bob was at the foot of the bed, watching me with big brown Bob eyes, probably trying to decide if I was food. Depending on Bob's mood, food could be almost anything. A chair, dirt, shoes, a cardboard box, a box of prunes, a table leg, a leg of lamb. Some food sat better with Bob than others. You didn't want to be too close after he ate a box of prunes. I pulled on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and trudged downstairs, hair uncombed, following the smell of coffee brewing. A note on the counter told me Bob had been fed and walked. Morelli was better at this cohabitation stuff than I was. Morelli was invigorated by sex. An orgasm for Morelli was like taking a vitamin pill. The more orgasms he had, the sharper he got. I'm the opposite. For me, an orgasm is like a shot of Valium. A night with Morelli, and the next morning I'm a big, contented cow. I was coffee mug in hand, debating the merits of toast versus cereal, when Morelli's doorbell rang. I scuffed to the door with Bob close on my heels, and I opened the door to Morelli's mother and grandmother. The Morelli men are all charming and handsome, and, with the exception of Joe, they're all worthless drunks and womanizers. They die in barroom fights, kill themselves in car crashes, and explode their livers. The Morelli women hold the family together, ruling with an iron hand, spotting a fib a mile away. Joe's mother was a revered and respected pillar of the community. Joe's grandma Bella sent a chill down the spine and into the heart of all who crossed her path.
"Aha!" Grandma Bella said. "I knew it.
I knew they were living together in a sin. I had a vision. It came to me last night.
Two doors down, Mrs. Frioli stuck her head out her front door so she didn't miss anything. I was guessing Grandma Bella's vision came to her last night after Mrs. Frioli called her. How nice to see you, I said to the women. What a nice surprise. I turned and shrieked up the stairs.
Joe, get down here!
It was always a shock to stand next to Mrs. Morelli and realize she was only 5'4" in her chunky 2-inch heeled shoes. She was a dominant and fearful force in a room. Her snapping black eyes could spot a speck of dust at 20 paces. She was a fierce guardian of her family and sat at the head of the table of the large Morelli tribe. She'd been widowed a lot of years and had never shown any interest in trying marriage a second time. Once around with a Morelli man was more than enough for most women. Grandma Bella was half a head shorter than Joe's mom, but no less fearsome. She kept her white hair pulled into a bun, tied at the nape of her narrow chicken neck. She wore somber black dresses and sensible shoes, and some people believed she had the ability to cast a spell. Grown men scurried for cover when she turned her pale old woman's eye on them or pointed her bony finger in their direction. "This is a temporary arrangement," I told Mrs. Morelli and Bella. "I had to leave my apartment for a couple days, and Joe was nice enough to let me stay here."
"Ah," Bella said, "I know your type. You take advantage of my grandson's good nature, and the next thing you know, you've seduced him and you're pregnant. I know these things. I see them in my visions."
Jeez, I hope these visions weren't too graphic. I didn't like the idea of being naked and woman on top in Bella's home movies. "It's not like that," I said. "I'm not going to get pregnant." I felt Joe move in behind me.
"What's up?"
Joe asked his mother and grandmother.
"I had a vision," Bella said. "I knew she was here."
"Lucky me,"
Joe said, and he ruffled my hair.
"I see babies," Bella said. "Mark my words, this one is pregnant."
"That would be nice," Joe said, "but I don't think so. You're getting your visions confused. Stephanie's sister is pregnant. Right kitchen, wrong pot."
My breath stuck in my chest. Did he say it would be nice if I was pregnant? When Joe left for work, I ran a computer check on McDonald's franchises in the area. I started dialing the numbers that turned up, asking for Howie, and I got a hit on the third McDonald's. Yes, I was told, a guy named Howie worked there. He would be in at 10. It was early, so I packed off in my happy yellow car, and I checked in at the office before cutting across town to look for Howie. "Anything happening?" I asked Connie.
"Vinny's at the pokey writing bail. Lula hasn't come in yet."
"Yes, she has," Lula said, bustling through the door,
big tote bag on her shoulder, take-out coffee in one hand, brown grocery bag in the other.
"I had to stop at the store on account of I need special food. There's a new man in my life, and I've decided I'm too much woman for him, so I'm losing some weight. I'm going to turn myself into a supermodel. I'm going to lose about 100 pounds. It'll be easy, because I joined Fat Busters last night. I got everything I need to lose weight now. I got a notebook to write in every time I eat something, and I got a Fat Busters book that tells me how to do it all. Every single food's got a number assigned to it. All you got to do is add up those numbers and make sure you don't go over your limit. Like my limit is 29.
Lula set the bag on the floor, plopped herself down on the couch, and took out a small notepad.
"Okay, here I go," she said. "This here's my first entry in my notebook. This here's the beginning of a new way of life."
Connie and I exchanged glances.
"Oh, boy," Connie said.
"I know I've tried diets in the past and they haven't worked out, but this is different," Lula said. "This one's realistic. That's what they say in the pamphlet. It's not like that last diet where all I could eat was bananas."
She paged through her Fat Busters book.
"Let's see how I'm doing. No points for coffee?"
"Wait a minute," I said. "You never get plain coffee. I bet that's a caramel macchiato you're drinking. I bet that's at least 4 points. Lula narrowed her eyes at me.
It says here coffee's got no points, and that's what I'm writing. I'm not getting involved with all that detail bullshit.
You have anything else for breakfast? Connie asked.
I had an egg. Let's see what an egg's gonna cost me. 2 points.
I looked over her shoulder at the book. Did you cook that egg yourself? Or did you get it on one of those fast food breakfast sandwiches with sausage and cheese?
It was on a sausage and cheese sandwich, but I didn't eat it all.
How much didn't you eat? Lula flapped her arms.
Okay, I ate it all.
That's got to be at least 10 points.
Huh, Lula said. Well, I still got a lot of points left for the rest of the day. I got 19 points left.
What's in the grocery bag?
Vegetables. You don't get any points for vegetables, so you can eat as much as you want.
I didn't know you were a big vegetable eater, Connie said.
I like beans when you put them in a pan with some bacon. And I like broccoli, except it's got to have cheese sauce on it.
Bacon and cheese sauce might up your points, Connie said.
Yeah, I'm going to have to wean myself off the bacon and cheese sauce if I want to get to supermodel weight.
I'm heading out to look for a guy named Howie. Supposedly he and Sing were buddies, I said to Connie. Anything new come in that I should know about?
We got a new skip this morning, but Vinny doesn't want anyone working on anything other than Sing. Vinny's in a state over this Sing thing.
Maybe I should go look for Howie with you, Lula said. If I stay here, I'll file all day, and filing makes me hungry. I don't know if I got enough vegetables for a full day of filing.
Bad idea. Howie works at a fast food place. You have no willpower when it comes to that stuff.
No problemo. I'm a changed woman. And anyway, I got my fill of fast food for the day. I had a good fast food breakfast.
A half hour later, Lula and I parked in the McDonald's lot. Lula had gone through a bunch of celery and was halfway into a bag of carrots.
This isn't doing much for me, she said. But I guess you gotta sacrifice if you want to be a supermodel.
Maybe you should wait in the car.
Hell no. I'm not missing out on the questioning. This could be an important lead. This Howie guy and Sing are supposed to be friends, right?
I don't know if they're friends. I just know Sing tried to find Howie the day before he disappeared.
Let's do it.
As soon as I was through the door to the restaurant, I spotted Howie. He was working a register, and he looked to be in his early 20s. He was dark-skinned and slim. Pakistani, maybe. I knew he was Howie because he was wearing a name tag, Howie P.
Yes, he asked, smiling. What will it be?
I slid a card across to him and introduced myself. I'm looking for Samuel Sing, I said. I understand your friends. He went immobile for a moment while he held my card. He appeared to be studying it, but I had a suspicion his mind wasn't keeping up with his eyes.
You are mistaken. I do not know Samuel Sing, he finally said. But what would you like to order?
Actually, I'd just like to talk to you, perhaps on your next break.
That would be my lunchtime at 1 o'clock, but you must order now. It is a rule.
There was a big guy standing behind me. He was wearing a sleeveless T-shirt, scruffy cutoffs, and mug-clogged grungy boots.
Cripes, lady, he said. You think we got all day? Give him your order. I gotta get back to work.
Lula turned and looked at him, and he moved to another register.
Huh, Lula said. I must take your order, Howie said.
Fine. Great. I'll have a cheeseburger, a large fries, a Coke, and an apple pie.
Maybe some chicken nuggets, Lula said.
No nuggets, I told Howie. What about Samuel Sing?
First, you must pay me for your food.
I shoved a 20 at him. Do you know where Sing is?
I do not. I am telling you I do not know him. Would you like extra ketchup packets with this cheeseburger? I have extra ketchup packets to give at my discretion.
Yeah, the extra ketchup would be great. If it was me, I would have gotten some chicken nuggets, Lula said. Always good to have nuggets.
You're not eating this, remember?
Well, maybe I could have had a nugget.
I took my bag of food. You have my card. Call me if you think of anything, I said to Howie. I'll try to stop back at 1. Howie nodded and smiled.
Yes, thank you. Have a good day. Thank you for eating at McDonald's.
He was nice and polite, Lula said when we got back to the car. But he didn't give us a lot.
She looked at the bag of food.
Boy, that smells good. I can smell the fries. Wonder how many points it would cost me to eat a French fry.
No one can eat just one French fry.
I bet supermodels eat just one French fry.
I didn't like the way Lula was looking at the bag. Her eyes were too wide and sort of bugged out of her head. "I'm going to throw this food away," I said. "I got it so I could talk to Howie. We don't really need this food."
"It's a sin to throw food away," Lula said. "There's children starving in Africa. They'd be happy to get this food. God's going to come get you if you throw that food away."
"First off, we're not in Africa, so I can't give this food to any of those starving kids. Second, neither of us needs this food. So God's just going to have to understand."
"I think you might be blaspheming God."
"I'm not blaspheming God." But just in case, I did a mental genuflect and asked for forgiveness. Guilt and fear remain long after blind belief.
"Give me that food bag," Lula said. "I'm going to save your immortal soul."
"No, remember the supermodel. Have some carrots."
"I hate those fucking carrots. Give me that bag."
"Stop it," I said. "You're getting scary."
"I need that burger. I'm out of control."
No shit. I was afraid if I didn't get rid of the bag, Lula would squash me like a bug. I eyed the distance between me and the trash receptacle, and I was pretty sure I could outsprint Lula, so I took off at a run.
"Hey," she yelled, "you come back here."
And then she pounded after me. I reached the trash and shoved the bag in. Lula knocked me out of the way, took the top off the trash receptacle, and retrieved the bag of food.
"This here is good as new," she said, testing a couple French fries.
She closed her eyes.
"Oh, man, they just made these fresh, and they got a lot of salt. I love it when they got a lot of salt."
I took a couple fries from the box. She was right. They were great fries. We finished the fries. Lula broke the cheeseburger in half, and we ate the cheeseburger. Then we each ate half of the apple pie.
"Would have been nice to have some nuggets," Lula said.
"You're a nut."
"It's not my fault. That was a bogus diet. I can't go around eating plain-ass vegetables all day. I'll get weak and die."
"Wouldn't want that to happen."
"Hell no," Lula said.
We went back to the car, and I called Ranger. "Having any luck?" I asked him.
"I found someone who saw Singh with the dog the day after it disappeared. It looks like Singh ran as opposed to getting himself whacked. And you were right. He took the dog with him."
"Any idea why he might want to disappear?"
"The future mother-in-law would do it for me."
"Anything else?"
"No. Have you got something?"
"I have a guy who says he doesn't know Singh, but I don't believe him. And I have horrific photos of a dead woman. Best to wait until I'm alone with Ranger to tell him about the horrific photos. Lula isn't always great at keeping a secret, and Morelli asked me not to share the details."
"Later,"
Ranger said. I called Connie next. "I need an address for a guy named Howie P. He works at the McDonald's on Lincoln Avenue. See if you can get his address out of the manager." 5 minutes later, Connie got back to me with the address. "This is the deal," I said to Lula. "We're going to check out Howie's apartment. We are not going to break in. You accidentally smash a window or bust down a door, and I swear I'll never take you on a case with me again."
"Huh," Lula said. "When did I ever bust down a door?"
2 days ago, and it was the wrong door."
"I didn't bust that door. I just tapped it open."
Howie lived in a hard times neighborhood a short distance from his job. He rented 2 rooms in a house that was originally designed to contain 1 family and now was home to 7. Paint peeled off the clapboard siding, and window ledges rotted in the sun. The small yard was hard-packed dirt, the perimeter marked by chain-link fencing. A fringe of weed clung to life at the base of the fence. Lula and I stood in the dark, musty foyer and ran through the names on the mailboxes. Howie was 3B. Sanji Kluchari was 3A.
"Hey, I know her," Lula said, "back when I was a hoe. She worked the corner across from me. If she's living in 3A, you can bet there's 8 other people in there with her. She's a scabby old crackhead doing whatever she has to so she can get her next fix."
"How old is she?"
"She's my age," Lula said. "And I'm not saying how old I am, but it's 20-something.
We climbed the stairs to the 2nd-floor landing, which was illuminated by a bare 20-watt bulb hanging from a ceiling cord. And then we went to the 3rd floor, which clearly